Jeffrey Canada's index finger on his right hand is crooked. Canada is a well-known education reformer, and in his book, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, he tells the story about the finger, why it's permanently bent at the top joint. So when people meet him and they've read the book, he says it's the first thing they do is they look for the finger. I did, backstage when I interviewed him for our speaker series in August. He's never had the finger fixed. In fact, he says he keeps it that way to remind him of the rules he learned on the streets. Don't cry. Don't act afraid. Don't tell your mother. Take it like a man. Canada has described his childhood and his neighborhood as a place with an all-encompassing sense of chaos and disorder. Even carrying around a quarter for the movies could make you a target.
We literally had to duck and hide. And we would try to get there without the kids stopping us. We used to keep our quarter in our socks because the kids would stop you and they would search you. They'd make you empty your pockets. Sometimes they'd make you take off your shoes, but not all the time. Certain blocks we couldn't go down. So even an innocent Saturday afternoon matinee was filled with fear and trauma. And you just lived with this all the time, especially when you left your block. And the only defense you would have against them was if you were armed.
In those days, South Bronx in the 60s, the weapon of choice was a knife. And the cool kids had one called a K-55. But Jeffrey couldn't afford it.
One day, I thought it was an act of God. Right on the street, there was an old rusty K-55. And it was just there, and I took it upstairs, and I oiled this thing up, and I sharpened it. Now, this is the thing. I'm going to tell you more about these knives than you need to know. The K-55 was a knife that had a spring on it. When you opened it, the thing was to open it halfway, and you would flick your wrist like this, and it would open up all the way. And we would practice getting it out your pocket. And the guys who were really good, they could literally put their hand in their pocket and do like this, and they'd have an open knife in their hand. So it meant they were instantly protected. And I was determined to master this. And so I kept trying to figure out what was the perfect balance where you could open that knife where the spring wouldn't close it. And I found the perfect balance. And when I went to flick my hand, it closed. And it closed right on that finger, and it cut the finger down to the bone. So now I'm sitting here. I know the bone stopped the knife from going through the finger. So I get it off, and the thing is bleeding. There's just blood everywhere. So I knew I needed to go to the doctor because I realized it was a tendon that was cut. The dilemma was, the only way to get to the doctor was I'm going to have to tell my mother. She was going to take the knife. And it was like I couldn't give this knife up. It was my only protection. It was my only sense of security. When I had that knife, I could travel anywhere in the Bronx. And the thing you have to understand, it was the fear and the anxiety was gone. You have to just imagine walking around all the time with this fear inside of you, and suddenly it's gone. And I said, no, I'm never going back to those days where I'm going to give this up. I'm going to keep this knife. And so I took two popsicle sticks, and I wrapped them around. I put a bandage on them. My mother came home and said, what happened to your hand? I said, I heard it playing basketball. And I got used to keeping my hand closed. Right, I would never open a hand up all the way, so you couldn't see that the finger was cut because the tendon never healed properly. And when my mother read Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, I must have been 40. She said to me, let me see your hand. And she literally smacked me right upside my head. I can't believe.
Jeffrey managed to get out of the Bronx, but he says the rules have stayed with him all his life. Even as he went on to the Harvard Graduate School of Education, even when he began to rethink some of the conventional ways of educating young people in the inner city, Canada created the Harlem Children's Zone, which takes up 97 city blocks, more than 14,000 kids. Today, we're broadcasting our conversation with Jeffrey Canada. This was the first in our speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. And here's why he tells the story about the finger. It's his way of illustrating this philosophy in the inner city that he learned when he was a kid, one that reduces life to a simple matter of survival, where you have to carry a knife because, as he said, either you get them or they get you.
You know, the kids would have a saying, you know, I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6. And it was this logic that seemed to make total sense that I think was just destroying the inner cities.
What did you learn about violence? Because one of the things you've talked about is that it's learned.
None of us knew how to fight when we were growing up. And I realized this was like, you had to pass this class. If you didn't pass this class, there were daily humiliations. Every day, someone was taking your money, taking your ball, slapping you around. It was just constant. So you made a calculation. Is it better to have this short fight and maybe get a bloody nose or something, or to take humiliation every single day, over and over and over again? And I began to study, and I wasn't the only one. There were a lot of us who began to study how to be tough. And you know what? Not only did we learn how to fight, but we learned how to look tough. I don't know if you've ever seen kids who just look. This was learned. We had to learn how to do that because you were judged instantly by other people. Were you one of the kids who they could pick on, or were you one of the kids who were going to fight back? And that was all in your affect, in your look. In the South Bronx, there was a whole ritual. When you went up to somebody you didn't know, it wasn't like, hi, how you doing? It was like, yo, what's up, man? What's up with you? You good? I'm good. You good? It was all of this. And it was, everybody was testing to see where, and we were running into these kids who had never done this before. And they were like, stay away from that guy. There's something wrong with him, right? So this learned response to violence went in deep, and it went in young, and it stayed. It literally stayed with me even till this day. This kind of, I think, exposure to trauma that happens when you're growing up in these environments. And even as things got better in New York, we know there are places that are as chaotic and as dangerous as any foreign country. Think about Iraq, you think about Afghanistan. It is much more dangerous to be a kid in certain cities of this country than to go overseas and serve your country. And here's the rub on that. If you go into the military, you get trained, you get a flak jacket, you get a helmet, you have a leadership, you have a weapon, and you get to get off the front lines. What happens if there's no way off the front lines? That you're sitting in your house, you're hearing gunshots, people are diving, you know, under the bed because you don't want the stray bullets to come. I mean, this is just, to me, a horrid existence to raise young people in. And we've tolerated this and allowed this in this country for too long. And part of what I was trying to do with this book was to say, these young people are trapped in this environment. They don't see a way out. It has a certain logic that makes sense when you're in it, that doesn't make any sense when you're out of there.
You talked about the logic of it when you're in it. At what point did you get away from it enough to see that the logic didn't make sense? And at what point did you decide that you wanted to craft a life, a career, to find some kind of solution to all of that? When did that happen?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a real story. I've never told this story before. I may have written about it. So my father left us when we were young. When I went to Harvard, he lived in Boston, and I hadn't seen the guy in 15 years. I just wanted to see what he looked like. And I went to meet him, and he met me, and we met on Commonwealth Avenue with some main thoroughfare there. And we were talking, and in the middle of talking, he had an apple, and he pulled out his knife to cut the apple. And I threw my knife away that day, and I never carried a knife again. And I just said, I'm not going down this road of just totally living in fear that in any given moment, because you believe that any given moment, but it's not so different from a lot of people feel about guns. At any given moment, you are going to be involved in some life or death struggle right? That you were going to have to kill or be killed. So you needed to have this weapon. And I just decided that that whole mindset was one that was undermining my relationship with my community, because you were thinking that, you know, this could happen at any given time. And it wasn't until I actually got from Massachusetts in back to New York in 83. By 84, I think I had my first kid that I ever worked with who was shot in 84. And he was the last one of my kids to be shot and actually live. And they made an example of this kid because kids were getting involved in drug sales. Now, when I was growing up, no kids were involved in selling drugs. You had to be a real tough adult to sell drugs. And teenagers, no one was doing. But when crack cocaine came in, this was a thing that, because you sold it all night, kids got into it, they understood it, and suddenly you had a bunch of kids with a bunch of money. And a lot of the guys, the older guys, who would go stick up a liquor store and worry about getting shot, they were like, that kid has more money, I'm going to get out the liquor store. So they started robbing the kids. And the logic made sense. Then what did the kids need? They needed a weapon. And so out of nowhere, we started seeing all of these weapons coming in. And I had a bunch of 14, 15, and 16-year-olds trying to figure out when to shoot and when not to shoot. And literally, there was carnage on the streets. And that lasted for about 12 or 14 years as I just watched more and more kids killed by handguns. I knew, this was the same time that Brady was shot with President Reagan, and folks started paying some attention to this issue of handguns, and I thought that we could convince the country to do something about this, but obviously that was not the case. But what I did warn was that this stuff was not staying in the inner cities. That people thought that this was just a thing happening in the Harlems, the Detroits, the Chicagos. Today, we live in a community where all of our kids are learning how to deal with the fact that people might walk into their schools and kill them. That's just normal America today. And I will just simply tell you, the trauma I grew up with, worried about somebody killing us, now we have a nation of kids who are growing up with that trauma.
There's a lot of questions about equity in your, you know, in this long journey of your life to reform education. You talk about the achievement gap. Yep. You talk about violence in the inner city and other places. You talk about the mistrust of law enforcement among, you know, communities of color. How are you reflecting on that now after all these years of looking? What are you seeing that might be different from what you were seeing growing up in the South Bronx? And how are you thinking today about these questions of equity and equality? We're making this distinction in the series between equity and equality, but how are you thinking about it now?
Well, boy, there's so many issues tied up in that question. One challenge I think that the whole nation is dealing with is the relationship between the police force and people of color, particularly African-American men. When I got back to Harlem in 83, the police had decided you couldn't arrest drug dealers because the kids had so much money they were bribing the cops, which meant there was open drug dealing going on all over Harlem. It was just like you come out, people were in lines, they were in line, middle of the day, police cars going by. This was just insanity. And I said, look, we need to do something. But the police at that time, people felt, were so corrupt that they were scared to go tell the police because they were afraid the police were going to tell the drug dealers and they was going. So one of the first things we had to do was rebuild the relationship between the police department and the community. And we were intermediaries in that because the people who need policing the most in these really dangerous communities, which are chaotic, they had to have the worst relationship with the police, which means they're at the mercy, right, of any homicidal kid who's out there with a handgun terrorizing everybody. Nobody knows what to do. Unfortunately, we're still trying to figure this out in this country today.
Do you think it's, how much of it is racism? How much of it is a misunderstanding of those, that trauma and those dynamics? That's kind of why I wanted you to start with that, because it seems like having that understanding, and if you don't come from that, you look at violence in a completely different way. So what do you think is the heart of it?
Yeah, it's really interesting because some of it is a set of beliefs on both sides, which tends to often escalate in ways that I think could be dangerous. On one set, you have a group of folks who have no experience with a community. They hear these stories, right? You have to think, if folks dealt with the worst issues happening in your community every day, and that's what they talked about, and that's what they talk about, you would grow up thinking, wow, we're in a wild place that anything might happen. And I've seen lots of police officers who are literally afraid. And when you're afraid, and it's one of the things I write in my book, the first time I ever faced a gun, they told me, if a person's afraid and they have a gun, they're liable to shoot you. There is racism. There are people who simply see black people and they see criminals. And when that happens, I think it's been going on so long until people had cell phones, folks didn't really realize how often that was happening. People thought, now you're making this stuff up. Look, my wife and I have grown kids, but we also have a 21-year-old. And every time he gets behind the wheel in our car, my wife and I say a prayer. Because you just hope the police officer he runs into is not afraid, right? Because I think they do shoot when they're afraid. Someone does something and they're thinking, oh, he's getting a gun, I'm going to shoot him. And it's this belief that everybody's out there going to get you. And that is labeled on a black person and not on a white person. So we did what most black people do with their kids. We went over it again. Now what happens? And what are you going to say? And where are your hands going to be? And how are you going to ask? Can you go in the glove compartment? And what are you going? And we go through that whole drill. This is the part, Doug, that I just want people to grasp. Because the thing that we're most afraid is that he could have a run-in with the police and be killed. We're not afraid that someone in the street's going to shoot him and kill him and he's going to be... We don't live in that kind of community. Or the thing we're afraid of is what, God forbid, they see him driving our car and they pull him over and somebody thinks the kid is reaching for something. And I think that is race. That is because you're black. You don't worry the same way if your kid is white and they're 20 and they're driving in a car. And that's something we have to do something about in this country. And I think, I was talking to a gentleman, I don't know where he is here, who works at one of our colleges that trains the police force, about actually working with police officers to recognize this issue and to begin to tamp this down. I will tell you, we have one of the best relationships with the police in Harlem because we work at it all the time. They know us. We know them. They know our kids. They know our kids are good kids. And we have an ability to intercede in ways that stop, I think, some of this misunderstanding from happening. I will also tell you, I have a thing. Anytime my kids are arrested, I say, what happened? I was standing out in front of my building. And what happened? The police officer came over. And what did he say? He said, I want to see some ID. And what did you say? I don't have to show you no ID. I said, and then what did he say? He said, yeah, you better produce some ID. And then what did you say? I say, I know the law. I said, and that's when he put the handcuffs on you, right? He's like, yeah, how did you know that? And the kids are almost right, right? Police officers do have a right to try and figure out whether or not, but they don't have an arbitrary right to just walk up to a bunch of black kids and say, you know, I demand this. There are lots of ways to diffuse this thing. And I try and teach my kids, oh, here are the eight other things you should have said. Right. Like, right? Other than I know the law. And it's a learning process, and we laugh and we joke, but it protects them because that officer doesn't care that kid's innocent. He's like, yeah, once you spend the rest of the afternoon in jail, you won't have such a smart mouth, right? That's a reaction to somebody else's kid, not your own kid.
Yeah.
Right? And that's part of the dynamic. And I think it's time that we all begin to grapple with this and realize that this is a real problem.
You know, as part of the speaker series last year, we had the writer for The New Yorker, Jelani Cobb, and he was one of the things that he was saying, and he was really clear about this, was there is no way we're going to be able to resolve these issues if we can't put them on the table and talk about them. Are you there? Is that where you are? We need to be able to have these really candid, frank conversations, and for some reason we're not.
Yeah, I really think that's the case. And part of the problem, I think part of the problem is what I say to my teachers and my staff. You know, we work with the most disadvantaged folks, and a lot of those parents have issues, and they're angry, and they're not going to be nice when they come in to deal with something, and you're liable to hear bad language and everything else. There's a way you work with parents like this. The first thing is you have to let them say everything, and you can't defend yourself. But you know what happens? As soon as they say something that you can prove is wrong, you say, no, Ms. Johnson, that didn't happen. Let me tell you what. And then you got conflict. Neither one of you are hearing one another. So we have to listen. Don't worry whether it's true or not. Don't worry about being, just make sure they get it all out. And then ask them, are you sure you have nothing else to say to me? And once it's all out, you can begin to say, okay, look, part of this I'm going to accept, part of this I'm not. I think this is what goes on when we begin to get to these tough issues, right? As soon as you say something I disagree with, I'm going to interrupt you. No, that's wrong. Let me tell you why that's wrong. And then we're not talking to one another anymore. Mm-hmm. We're debating, and we leave with exactly the same attitudes that we came in with. And I think that we just need to begin to have these conversations in some ways that allow us to understand the other person, even if we don't agree with them. They have a position, they have a point of view, and we should listen to that, and we should respect that, and we should hope that they would do the same for us. And when you get to these touchy issues, you find it becomes increasingly difficult to even have the initial part of that conversation.
Yeah.
Because the other thing is people don't want to be blamed. People are like, well, you sound like you're blaming all of us for something else. I didn't have anything to do with that. Why are you blaming me? And I think folks are, yeah, I want to blame you, right? I want to blame somebody. You're there. You're going to take the blame for this, right? So part of this is just, I think, part of human nature. And unfortunately, I think we haven't learned a set of skills of how we listen and how we don't internalize stuff and become so defensive that we can't actually have a constructive conversation.
Jeffrey Canada, he's the president of the Harlem Children's Zone. He joined us in August for a conversation as part of our speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. I should mention that later this month, October 23rd, we're going to be hosting the final event in that series. The activist Brittany Packnett will join us. She's been at the forefront of the Black Lives Matter movement. For details about it, you can go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. This is Radio West.
Hey, it's Lee Hale, host of the Preach podcast. So, for a lot of faiths, having answers to life's biggest questions is kind of the point, especially what happens when we die. But my guest this week, Simranjeet Singh, says that's not quite how it works in Sikhism.
In many ways, the Sikh tradition doesn't ask some of the questions that we expect religious traditions to ask.
Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today, we're broadcasting our conversation with Jeffrey Canada. He's the president of the Harlem Children's Zone. He joined us in August for a conversation in front of a live audience at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. This was part of our speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake.
You've talked about the strategies that you developed when you started to put together this experiment of the Harlem Children's Zone. One of them was that it was going to be, as I mentioned in the introduction, this was going to be all-encompassing. That was a really important thing, and we can talk about that. You were going to scale up. We're going big, which was interesting. We're going to use data. We're going to train educators, and we're going to hold them accountable. And we're going to talk about a few of those, but I want to just talk specifically about what seemed to me the number one issue here for you, the number one strategy, which was rebuild community.
Yeah.
Would you talk a little bit, what does that mean? How do you rebuild community? And I know you get this question all the time. I get how maybe you would think about rebuilding the Bronx, Harlem. How do you rebuild a community in rural Utah or a reservation in southwestern Utah?
I mean, it's a great question. I like to, sometimes I'm dealing with facts. This is not one of those times, all right? Because there's no science on this, but I honestly believe communities have their own gravity. And what the gravity does is it pulls everybody back towards the norm, whatever the norm is in that community. So I don't know if you all know about Raj Chetty's work, but he talked about place and why place matters. And he looked at, 10 million Social Security records. And he realized if you move a poor kid into a middle class community, that in and of itself is going to increase the earnings significantly if nothing else changes. Just that move, I think, up until 14. After that, no difference. Has no impact on the parent, by the way. But it has total impact on the kid. And that, to me, is just the gravity. And what does the gravity look like in a poor community? Fear, anxiety, substance abuse, gangs, violence, lousy schools. I mean, maybe you can get over one of those hurdles. Maybe you can get over two. Maybe you can get over six. But when it's one hurdle after the other hurdle after the other hurdle, and you face it at birth, you face it at four, you face it in elementary school, you face a different set of hurdles in middle school, even more hurdles in high school, after a while, that gravity just pulls you down. A kid is looking great at 9. You see him at 16, you're like, how'd he end up on the corner, right? I know the kid was going to church, but gravity got him. And part of what happens in our communities is you can do a lot with an individual kid. That's why I'm not so, it's great to have a school that's good. It doesn't change the gravity of a community. Those kids are still going to live in a place where kids are going to be pulling them back towards the norm. Here's the example I give around this issue of gravity. We started Harlem Children's Zone. I had about, the first year we listed it on the board, I had about 14 of my kids in college. And I remember I was trying to raise money. I said, I'm trying to get my kids in college. And it's like, 14, big deal. I said, but we're going to get more every year. So now we have about 950 kids in college. So but this is, I'm talking about gravity though. So this is what happens. When you have a place like Harlem, you have 14 kids in college. You ask a kid on the block, you think you go to college? You know anybody going to college? I don't know anybody who goes to college from Harlem, right? I think I heard of this girl on 117th Street who went to college. Could you go? No, you have to be a genius to go to college. No one from here goes to college. When you have 900 plus kids in a community going to college, you ask somebody to go to college. Of course I can go to college. He's in college. Look at him, right? And you see, because you see, it's not like all of these brilliant people in college. You see the guy next door and the girl down the block, they're all in college. So what do you begin to believe? Oh, yeah, of course I'm going to college. I'm going to be like everybody else. You've changed the gravity. Suddenly, if you're not in college, something's wrong. Like, why aren't you in college? Everybody around here goes to college.
Is that what you meant when you said kids pass values like a virus?
That's right. Exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. If you have a community filled with guns, kids grow up learning about guns and how to use guns and shoot guns. If you move that kid to a middle-class community, he's not going to sit on a corner and say, you know what, I think I'm going to start my own gang. I think I'm going to get a color like turquoise and I'm going to call. It just doesn't happen, right? That value, even if that kid belonged, that value is not going to be able to infect other kids. And I tell folk, hope, like despair, is contagious. When people constantly see folks not making it, they think, well, you don't make it from this place, and it becomes the norm. So yeah, you can get high, you can do whatever, because what's the point? And part of this to me is the signals your community gives you. I'm going to get to this issue you mentioned about rural. But here was the signal. Harlem was a dump. Garbage everywhere. Graffiti over everything. Half of the buildings were abandoned. Kids grew up knowing this was the place of last resort. If you could make it, you got out of there. That was by definition making it, was getting out of Harlem. And I tell folks, when the definition of making it is getting out of your community, well, guess what happens? All your talent leaves, right? And guess who gets stuck there? So we said, we have to change this thing. And the thing I told folks is we changed it one block at a time. I'll give you a quick example of what gravity looks like. So we have a lot of violence. And we have a group we call Peacemakers, AmeriCorps workers, a bunch of young kids. They're really energetic. So I said, okay, we're going to go on this one block we're working on, 119th Street, a lot of drug dealing and stuff going on that block. And we're going to do a community building exercise. We're going to do something nice for the kids and all that stuff. So I come on the block. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. We're setting up. I see these speakers, and the speakers are literally 12 feet high. And I'm just looking. I'm like, Who authorized you? We don't have that kind of money. You can't. They're like, those aren't our speakers. I said, well, whose speakers are they? They said, those are drug dealer speakers. I said, what are you talking about? Oh, they said, oh, this is their block party day. So I'm thinking, and you thought it was a good idea for us to have our party the same day? But this is what happened. Once a year in the summer, the drug dealers threw a block party. Music, little pony rides, games for the kids. And I'm sitting there saying they do this every summer. Say, oh, yeah. So if you're 9, who do you think the good guys are? And I just thought to myself, how did we let this happen? How did that this becomes the norm? So I said to my guys, okay, I think it was a good idea, maybe a little poor execution. I don't think we want to take these guys on today. But we did find Mother Pearl, who lived in her building for 35 years. She remembered before Harlem went down. And Mother Pearl believed that Harlem could come back, but she had no support, no resources. We told Mother Pearl, from now on, you're throwing a block party for these kids. We're going to just put this power back in the hands of the citizens so that they don't think that no one here has any ability to do anything except the guys who are hustling, because those 10-year-olds think they're going to inherit that corner. That's what they think. Who cares about school or anything else? That's going to be my corner. And what do I have to do to get that corner? I have to be tough. I have to be aggressive. I have to be prepared to kill somebody. Right? So I better start practicing that now. We wanted to get that out of there and get them focused on, you know, math and science and playing sports and all of that kind of stuff. We went block by block. When I say block by block, we knocked on every single door and we said to folks, we want to know if you're interested in improving this community for children. As long as we kept children at the center, even the drug dealers in the end who knew we were like anti-drug, they gave us a pass because we had their brothers and sisters. And they hoped for something better for them because they knew what was going to happen to them. They're either going to die, they wouldn't go to jail. There were no middle-aged drug dealers in Harlem. That was a profession. If you went into that, you knew there were going to be two outcomes. You were going to get killed or you're going to go to jail. So you did as long as you could do and you spent as much money as you could spend. You had as much fun as you could have for as long as you could do it because you knew what was going to be the end result. But if you thought, these guys are trying to stop my brother from doing this and I don't want to see him get trapped in this thing, you didn't like us and you mumbled stuff when we walked by, but you gave us a pass. You let us get the kids. You let them get in the program. You let us get those kids back home safe. And we said, that's the beginning. Now we just have to wait for that group, right? That was 20 years ago. That group is now gone, right? They went wherever they go, and we've got a group of kids now who believe in Harlem, you go to college. That's what kids do.
It's interesting to me. I was wondering, gosh, I wonder, can you replicate this plan, which is so particular to the inner city, yeah, in Vernal, Utah, in a rural, yeah, community, for example? And it seems like maybe not exactly, yeah, but there are some basic principles. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's a great question, Doug, because so when we tried to do this work, right, no one believed it could be done, right? You're talking about Harlem had been the same. It had been sort of the example of a failing community for 35, 40 years. And we had this big idea and no one would give us any money because they thought it was crazy. And George Soros ended up giving us the first money to support this. And then there was like this algebraic equation. They said, well, Jeff is crazy, but George is not. George gave him some money. So maybe, you know, so we started getting some money to support this. But this is what people said. It couldn't be done. And then once we started getting results, they said, you're the only one who could do it. And I said, wait, first you said it couldn't be done. Now you're saying only one who could do it. This is based on a set of principles. I keep saying to people, it can be done. It can be replicated. You have to be serious. You have to be able to get the resources. You have to be able to hold people accountable. I mean, there are two big issues you're dealing with this work. One is complexity, right? Because you're intentionally going to the most devastated communities and trying to fix a myriad of problems from birth through college. That's very complex. The other is scale. And scale limits, you know, you can put together a small program, that's great. But can you put together a program that serves thousands and thousands? Can you actually scale that up? So this has baffled folks. But to answer your question, the principles are the same, even if some of the tactics are different. The answer to your question is a place called Berea, Kentucky. Berea, Kentucky is a very rural, it's part of Appalachia. Berea is a college that got a promised neighborhood. And I am telling you, the work they have done there is just nothing. It is not like what we're doing in Harlem. They have a whole different set of issues. But the same set of principles underpin all of the work. And I think that's the key to this. You don't have to do exactly what anybody else does. You just have to understand those principles, right? And those principles, I think, when it comes to, creating this cradle to career pathway, using data for real in real time, actually holding folks accountable, making sure that you're targeting the most vulnerable families, that this rebuilding of a sense of community and what that means, because remember, if by definition people are describing their community as a place you succeed when you get out of, I don't care what kind of work there, you're not going to fix that community because everybody's going to leave, right? You got to change what it means to be in that community. Now, the problem in Harlem was things have changed so much that no one can afford to live there anymore. But it's really not funny because it's really true that it's unaffordable. So now my families, if they lose their place, they have to leave Harlem. They can't afford. And even my kids who graduate from college can't afford to get a place in Harlem. That's gentrification. That's a different set of issues. What we were trying to do was make Harlem a community where our kids wanted to come back, because when they come back from college, we wanted them to raise their families in Harlem and be part of that rebirth of that community. So that piece, I think you can see in a rural community. It looks different. Mm. It feels different. When I went there, I went to Berea, and I said, do you want me to come in and talk to the community? They said, Jeff, you would not be well received in Berea. All right. I said, oh, it's that kind of community. All right. It doesn't matter. We want this to work for kids who have been sort of failing for decades. And that's what was happening. And as you know, this is happening in lots of places in this country that people don't think about. People think about the big places. But I will tell you, there are just thousands of small communities that have the outcomes that are just as bad. And when you add to that, one of the things that I am most worried about. So I'm going to say to you all here who are doing a great job, there are two issues that I worry about. One is the downturn in the economy, right? Because guess what happens? You know, last hired, right? First fired. And all of that work can be undone. And what I went to my board and said, this is for Bill and the board members from the United Way. When the economy turns down, we got to actually spend more money because our family is going to be under even more. Now that family, that working mom who was barely making things meet, now she's suddenly out of work after busting her rear end for years and feeling alone and like no one cares, and she's going to get depressed, and then that's going to impact the kid, and it's going to undo all of our work. So we got to do additional stuff. The other issue is the opioid and the drug epidemic, which the people who think about this in terms of deaths, I don't. I think about it in terms of how many people are left alive because the families suffer and the children suffer the most. And I watched this destroy the South Bronx, and I watched it destroy Harlem. And it doesn't happen just simply because people are using drugs. It happens because it blows apart community, and it blows apart family, and people stop trusting one another, and suddenly everybody is a suspect. And that is the worst thing for community. So those two issues, I think, impact areas across this country that people don't know about. And I know how it's undermining those communities. And yes, they need a strategy that looks similar, even though it's going to have differences.
I wanted to ask you about our cultural priorities. One of the things I heard you talk about how much it costs to incarcerate someone for a year.
Yeah.
I think at the time, I'm not sure what the figure is now, you were mentioning it was like $147,000 a year.
New York City jail. That's what it costs.
So, but no one blinks an eye at that. But when you think about the amount of money it would cost to get a kid into college, that's a strain for some reason. What's going on? What's the cultural priority there? Why are we thinking that way?
Here, I think There's been a focus on some of how we began to develop a belief set that we have today. And there's a lot of talk about the crime bill and when it was done. I went and testified in front of, he was Senator Biden, and saying that this belief, and there was a guy from Princeton whose name was John DeLulio, and he had come up with this concept, which seemed to make some sense, that all of these kids being born to parents who were on crack were going to fuel an even more explosive group of kids, and they were called super predators. Right? And they were talking about these poor inner city kids. And I remember I brought some folks into one of my kindergarten classrooms. I said, I want you to come look at the super predators and see what they really look like. Right? And the person was like, come on, Jeff. Well, I said, no, because that's what you're saying. You're telling me these kids are going to grow up to be the worst murderers ever. And it's just because of stuff that happened in there with their parents. Well, what this did was it fueled a response that folks thought the way we're losing control and the way we're going to regain control, we're going to lock them all up. And they spared no expense. In New York, I watched the prison population go from about 20,000 to 60,000 folk. These were mostly people of color. And it was just a huge, huge waste of time and resources and money. And I watched them cut the programs that would give kids jobs and prevent them from ending up in jail because they had to pay for the prison budget. And the police and prison budgets became like this huge driver of all of the budgets around this country because this went on all over America. And this is, again, was tied to race, that folks really believed that punitive actions were what was needed. And I tell folks, the good example of this is just to look at the response to the heroin epidemic that happened when I was a teenager in the inner cities in the late 60s and early 70s. They just said, we have a war on drugs. We're going to lock all these people up. Now that it is really rampant in white America, every presidential candidate, including governor of New Jersey, who was crying about the addiction in his family and how we had to get more dollars. And he was a prosecutor. How we had to get more dollars to help these poor people who had a brain illness. And I'm sitting there saying, yeah, that's after 25 years of locking up all the people of color and thinking you can give them as much time as possible. That kind of policy decisions, right? Where on the one hand, we're thinking we need prevention, we need treatment. On the other hand, we're thinking we need jails and we need prisons. Very much tied to race, and we have spent a fortune. And here's the problem. We did spend a fortune without blinking an eye. And as soon as you run a program, the first thing people want to say, how much it costs. And I've heard a lot of folks say, when we say we spend $5,000 a kid, we spend less because we serve adults. But I wanted to use that number, 5,000. Why? Because I just wanted to say to America, you can't solve this stuff on the cheap. We keep trying to do that. It's not possible. If you really want to invest in your kids and make sure they end up paying taxes and working hard and taking care of their families, you need to do an investment in these kids. And why you can ignore that investment, and then that kid turns 18, and you don't blink an eye, and New York State is 60,000 to lock a kid up, and New York City is 147,000. You don't blink an eye about those numbers. That, to me, is immoral and, I think, unethical. And I think it's one thing if you don't know any better, but we're trying to now say to people, we know better than this. And it doesn't solve the problem.
Do you think that the people are making the argument that we should pump a lot of money into prisons and law enforcement budgets as opposed to social systems and preventing that, that they're just better messengers? They have a better message, or that it's the idea of being afraid of criminals, of super predators, is just so visceral that it's an easy message to tell.
Here, unfortunately, we have to deal with part of the anatomy of some of our politicians called a spine. And this is what I mean by that. We've seen it happen. You release somebody on parole, they end up doing some horrendous crime, and everybody says, no more parole. right? I'm against this because of whatever. So the we've seen presidents get elected on this, right? You just find somebody who was released back into society. Now, when look, before the big explosion in jails, there were education programs, there were exercise programs. People thought, yeah, you send somebody to jail, they do their time, but at least let them learn. They took away all that stuff. This was like, no, this has to be punishment. It has to be brutal. We have to make sure people get this. This is a political messaging, meaning it's much easier for me to stand up there and say, I am tough on crime and I'm going to stop this stuff and I'm going to lock them all up, than to have to do a more nuanced, yes, I want to be tough on crime, but I want to do it in a way that doesn't cause permanent damage to these communities and to these families. Folks found that message sounded like you were really weak. And people began to say, you're weak on crime. And that became just one of those litmus tests in this country. And I think now there's been a pushback to say maybe this big investment was a mistake. And you see Republicans and Democrats saying we've got to rethink some of this criminal justice stuff. And I think we're seeing some real criminal justice reform. But I will tell you, half of the reason for that reform is that we bankrupted our states. They just couldn't afford to keep doing this. And after a while, guess why we pay teachers what we pay them? Because we built all those jails and we're spending all our money there. And you make more money if you're working inside the prison than if you do teaching. And that's just undermined the budgets across this country. So that and some good messaging, right? I think people were able to say, you can't keep doing this. And by the way, here's a more humane way. And some of this stuff is racist that we've been doing. I think that began to change some of the conversations.
We're about out of time here, but I wanted to ask you to tell one final story, if you would, because it sort of came to me, this question about, gosh, how often, was there ever a time when you're like, I'm not doing this anymore. I can't really do this anymore. And there's the story you tell in your book about Alex, your nephew.
Yeah.
And you talk, he was killed, and you can talk a little bit about the feeling you were having, but you write this in your book.
Yeah.
About this moment where you wanted to yell to the children, get off the street. Don't you know it's not safe here? People are being killed every day. Go inside and lock your doors. Run and hide, run and hide.
Yeah.
It seems like this was a moment when you thought, but then you say, you decided to stay. Like there was a moment when you wanted to leave and just say, I can't do this anymore. What was happening here?
You know, the issue with Alex, my nephew, my wife and I, I had to go in and identify the body, and it was perfect. He looked perfect. He was dead. The suddenness of being alive and being dead. And the guy who shot him didn't know him, didn't intend to even shoot him. He just happened to be on the phone when the guy was shooting, and now he's dead. And I'm thinking of his four kids. And I just thought, you know, this is a little bit like, you know, playing Russian roulette where you have no control. You're just out there, you're walking around, you could die. And telling kids to invest all this time and energy and effort into preparing for a life when you could end up like Alex the next moment just seemed to me at that moment to be futile. And I just felt like, you know what, I think they won. Right? Too many guns. It's just too random. It happens all the time. I'm going to have to go to this sad, sad funeral now, and all of us are going to be traumatized again. I went to teach my martial arts class. I've taught martial arts for quite a long time. And I remember I went in to see the kids, and they had never seen me look down. You know, I'm their sensei, I'm this guy who do all this stuff. And I could just see the fear, because they were thinking, if they can get you, what chance do I have? And I just looked at those kids and I said, I can't be that person that's the example of why this thing can't be beat, because they even got the guy that we thought was going to save us. And it made me go, and my wife and I, we sat down, we talked about it, we prayed about it, and we said, we're going to end this slaughter. And We started peace marches. We just celebrated our 25th anniversary of our peace march that we do through Harlem every year. We say to the Harlem community, our kids want to live, and you all need to respect that. And we get the kids out there by the thousands, and we just celebrate the fact that they're alive, and we think that's the minimum level we have to have in our community.
Jeffrey Canada. He's the president of the Harlem Children's Zone. He joined us in August for a live conversation as part of our speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. Later this month, the activist Brittany Packnett will join us for the final event of that series. You can find out more by going to our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. Our thanks to Bill Krim, to Ashley Razan, and the rest of the team at United Way of Salt Lake. The program is produced by Tim Slover and Benjamin Bombard. Natu Twe is our intern. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.